Judges of the United States Court of Appeals, in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are advised to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument is Joy versus Hay Group. Mr. DeGrand.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The district court ruled that my client, Lynn Joy, was fired for cause, as that term is used in her written employment agreement, and that therefore she was not entitled to her promised severance as a matter of law. For a number of reasons, we respectfully submit that the court erred in so ruling. The court was wrong to conclude that the term cause was capable of being defined in a single reasonable way. The court was wrong to base its construction of the party's contract on a dictionary definition that rendered the promise of severance illusory. The court was wrong to reject without hearing any testimony, reliable, objective evidence regarding what the parties intended, including evidence from the very drafter of the agreement on behalf of the company. And the court was wrong to conclude without a trial that Ms. Joy was fired for cause under any reasonable construction of the term. We do not contend that this agreement constrained the company's ability to fire Ms. Joy. We concede that HGI had the right to fire her as it did for any reason or no reason at all. She was, as HGI rightly notes, an employee at will, and this is not a wrongful discharge lawsuit. What is at stake here is a promise of severance, a financial bridge from one job to another. And this bridge was an important inducement to my client when she accepted the job with the company in 1996. At that time, she was told by the company that cause would exist for firing her and she would therefore lose her severance in one of three specific circumstances: conviction of a felony, willful misconduct resulting in demonstrable damage to the company, and theft of company property. The lower court found that HGI had admitted that it explained this definition to Joy when she was presented with and agreed to her employment agreement. This severance commitment was compensation she earned when she accepted the job. At the very least, she earned it over the course of the 6 years of her employment. It makes sense that the parties would limit the circumstances under which she would forfeit that compensation, just as she would not be expected to forfeit other earned compensation for wages.
Mr. DeGrand, what was the amount of the severance?
It was 1 year's salary, Judge, $210,000. The district court ruled that the phrase "for reasons other than cause," although not defined in the agreement, is unambiguous and susceptible to a single reasonable construction. This construction, the court found, in a dictionary definition of the word cause, a reason, motive, or ground for some action. There are at least two problems with this construction. The first is a language problem. The agreement itself speaks in terms of reasons other than cause, clearly suggesting that cause is a subset of the broader concept of reasons. If cause simply means a reason, this language makes...
So what is your definition of cause?
My definition of cause, Judge, is defined by the extrinsic evidence that was submitted to the lower court.
Well, I'm asking what your definition is.
Willful misconduct, theft of company property, conviction of a felony.
That's all?
That's too narrow, yeah.
That's all?
In this particular case, it is, Judge.
What if she just doesn't do any work?
I would consider that willful misconduct.
Pardon?
I would consider that willful misconduct.
What if she's incapable of work?
Well, that's not addressed by the agreement, which is one of the points we raise in the briefs, and I think that makes the clause
ambiguous.
Well,
what if she's just incapable? What if she has a stroke or something and she can't work?
I would not consider that to be cause under this definition, Judge. And clearly what Your Honor asks raises an ambiguity in the agreement. It's not addressing the agreement what happens if she becomes disabled. It's not addressing the agreement what happens if she is convicted of a crime. And the Illinois courts have clearly held that this term, undefined and standing alone in an agreement, is ambiguous and therefore requires extrinsic evidence. In this case, That extrinsic evidence shows that the parties meant something very specific.
Well, if she just unjustifiably failed to make any effort to bring in business, would that be willful misconduct?
I would argue that it probably would. That's not the case here.
Yes, I know.
How do you address Gear and its description of for cause?
First of all, in that case, the issue of ambiguity had not been raised by the parties. It's not even clear from the decision in that case how the parties' agreement defined cause and whether they defined it more narrowly than reasonable cause, which is the language that the court referenced. Secondly, neither party submitted a competing interpretation of the term. The record before the court in that case clearly disclosed that this person had serious performance issues, unlike Ms. Joy in this case. And I don't think that case can be read as broadly as HGI suggests to mean that for all time, in all contexts, and as a matter of law, cause means one thing and one thing only, and that is unacceptable or unsatisfactory performance. But even if the intrinsic ambiguity is rejected, even if the court were to find that Judge Guzman was right, that this clause or this term is capable of only a single reasonable construction, we submitted important and reliable objective evidence of what the parties intended by this term in their agreement. The individual whose very words these were, David Lacey, submitted a statement to the lower court. Mr. Lacey was the HGI executive who drafted the agreement, and he stated that the phrase "for reasons other than cause" meant exactly what had been explained to Ms. Joy at the time that she signed the agreement. He told the court what the true intent of his words were. Who better to speak to the party's true intent than the individual who drafted the agreement for the company? Without hearing Mr. Lacey testify, the district court rejected his statement as not sufficiently objective. This was based on a lone comment made at Ms. Joy's deposition about some unidentified frustration that Mr. Lacey had with the company regarding a lack of support on a particular project 6 years before he submitted his statement. But Mr. Lacey had not worked for the company for more than 6 years when he submitted his statement to the lower court, and there is nothing in the record to suggest that he was an interested witness. He was not allowed to testify, and the trial court, in fact, did not even have his deposition testimony before it when it decided to reject his statement as to what the parties intended by their agreement. We submit it was wrong for the trial court to refuse to consider this evidence without even hearing him testify. Webb Bassick, the HGI executive who signed the agreement, again for the company, also provided a statement that this was the party's intent. Both Bassick and Lacey stated that this definition of cause was taken from prior employment agreements that Mr. Bassick had negotiated for his clients. The district court found it to be an admitted fact that this definition was explained to Ms. Joy when she was presented with and asked to sign the employment agreement. And HGI's own model of employment agreement, the agreement they hold up as a template for their clients, contains a similar definition. This is not, I would submit, your typical he said, she said situation where one party claims to have had a conversation with the other side regarding the terms of the party's agreement, which the other side denies.
What if cause includes just unsatisfactory performance? Would that be the end of your case, or would you argue that?
No, it wouldn't be the end of my case, Judge, because in fact, HGI never linked my client's performance to the decision to terminate her. We asked a very specific question of the company below. Why did you fire Lynn Joy? And the reason we got back was economic. There wasn't enough work for her to do, and she was not able to generate sufficient additional work independently.
How many employees does HGI have?
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that question.
Is it a large company?
It is a very large company. But declining sales happen all the time for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they happen because of unsatisfactory performance by the employee. Sometimes they happen because of economic factors, which the record shows here. Sometimes they happen because the company itself is making it more difficult for the employee to meet the goals that have been established for her. What they never said was that her inability to generate sufficient billable hours was in any way related to her performance or a failure of performance by Lynn Joy. That is not cause under any reasonable construction of the term, poor performance, unsatisfactory performance, or otherwise. Her supervisor, for all but 1 week of her employment, told the lower court that her work was exemplary for the entire course of her employment by the company. And that is a fact that HEI admitted in its response to our Rule 56 statement. And the company said, and the lower court accepted, that the company said and the lower court accepted that there was no deficiency in the quality of her performance as an employee. Even when they sent the performance memoranda in August 2001 and February of 2002, they agreed that those memoranda were not intended to address the quality of her performance as an employee. There is simply nothing to link this employee's performance to the decision to terminate her, so therefore there is not cause under any reasonable construction of the term. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time.
Thank you, Mr. Graham. Ms. Comiskey?
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Hope Comiskey. I'm counsel for Hague Group, Inc. in this case. I'd like to address each of the 4 points that were raised by Mr. DeGrand in his discussion on the severance issue.
It's kind of funny that a company that specializes in executive compensation can't draft a clear employment agreement.
Your Honor, this is clear.
Clause isn't clear. Clause could mean anything.
Your Honor, cause, if you look at the four corners of this agreement, it is unambiguous in this context. She was an employee.
The word cause is not defined.
That's right. It's not defined, but it's defined under Illinois law, and it's defined under this court's opinion in Guyer, Your Honor.
Defined under Illinois law. You're saying every contract in Illinois that uses the word cause has the same meaning?
I say that every contract in Illinois that uses the word cause includes poor performance, and that's the only thing that this
includes
court has
what?
To...
I'm sorry.
Poor performance. Poor performance, and that's the only thing that this court has to agree upon to affirm the district court's decision in this case. The district court said that cause included poor performance. Ms. Joy was terminated for poor performance. There's no question about that in the record, and I'll go through that in a moment.
Is that poor performance, is that an objective standard or subjective?
In this case, it was objective. She had was given two specific performance plans.
That wasn't my question. My question is it an objective concept or a subjective concept?
Your Honor, you don't have to answer that question.
I'm asking you a question.
It could be
what
both.
Your answer, whether I need it or not.
It could be both.
Well, I don't want both. I'm asking you.
It depends the kind of job, Your Honor. If you have a sales job and you have a job where you have to bill hours, that's
objective.
Wait, you're
talking too fast. I can't follow you.
If you have a sales job and you have quotas like the plaintiff and Guyer, then it's an objective situation. If you're a market manager, like in...
Well, what is it in this case?
In this case, it's objective, Your Honor. She had billing...
So now what you're saying is this term cause, which you think is so clear, means one thing when the employee is in sales and another thing when the employee is a manager.
No, I think it means poor performance in each of those situations.
No, but you say it's a subjective standard when we're talking about a manager, but it's objective when we're talking about a salesman. Isn't that what you just said?
To determine what...
Isn't that what you just said?
Your Honor, yes, it depends.
Isn't that what you just said?
Yes, because it depends on what the duties of the employee were. Okay. If the employee has duties that require objective evaluation to determine whether the performance is poor or not poor, then you look at the objective standards. If it's a vice president of a company who doesn't necessarily have objective standards, then you have to look at other standards. Does he get along with the subordinates?
That makes her entitlement to severance completely illusory.
Your Honor, I disagree.
What would be a situation in which she'd be entitled to severance?
She'd be entitled to severance if she had not, if she had performed properly and there was a reduction in force, Your Honor. Okay, she'd performed properly, there was an economic turndown, the company had to lay people off, she would be entitled to severance.
That did not happen here. That's it, just a riff, that's the only situation. Is there no other situation which she'd be entitled to severance?
There may be, Your Honor. I can't think of anything at the moment.
And you think it's obvious under Illinois law that a RIF is the only basis for that everything that isn't a RIF is for cause?
Your Honor, I think it's obvious under Illinois law that poor performance constitutes cause for termination. And cause equals poor performance. That's what I think is obvious under Illinois law, based on the Geyer case, also on the decision in Van Devere, which we've cited as well. The Tenth Circuit had a similar issue in the Weir case,
but
and they're the same way.
It's unusual in American law to have a state or a federal government courts like that purport to establish a meaning for a term that governs every contract it appears in.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I did not
get the
question.
It's unusual in American law for a court to say, if the word X appears in a contract, it means the following. I mean, usually it's understood meaning of the words in a contract depends on the particular contract rather than on some...
Well, Your Honor, the Four Corners Rule...
Has Illinois ever said the word cause, when it appears in a contract, means the following?
It says that... in Van Devere, we say that the court ruled that unsatisfactory performance constitutes cause for discharge because the plaintiff's satisfactory performance of his duties is implicit in the employment relationship. So the answer to that question, in our view, is yes.
What case?
The Van Devere case, yes.
Uh-huh. That's the Illinois Court of Appeals, right?
Correct. And, Your Honor, we believe
that's
that...
That's why we call it the appellate court here.
I know. It depends on your background, I guess.
We also believe that Geyer holds that. But I'd like to talk about this issue about the dictionary definition. The court does not have to reach the dictionary definition, as this court well knows that you can affirm on any basis that the lower court ruled upon. And that's the Rowan case that we said in our brief. And the court certainly... ruled that poor performance was cause in this case, and so that dictionary definition is a red herring. I'd like to talk about her actual performance, because Your Honor did ask a question about her actual performance. We had specific performance goals.
In Van Devere, what was the nature of the employee's unsatisfactory performance?
If I can get the case, Your Honor, I could probably answer that. It was a commission's case, Your Honor, and there was actually no issue in that case as to whether the person sold the commissions. This was just a termination by the employer, almost like a reduction in force. So the court in that situation said...
But you said a reduction of force in force.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Because
there was no written contract.
Yes, there was no written contract there. It was the commission's case. They terminated the relationship, I think, because he did not... sell enough, and he was asking for commissions on materials that he sold. I'm sorry I don't have that sufficiently set forth, but it is reduced in our brief. They said that he was not servicing the accounts properly, I found, and I'm sorry. It's
so
on the last
discharge
page.
Discharge case.
Yes,
now,
he was not servicing the accounts properly, and he thought that it was best that the employee no longer represent the employer.
Isn't it plausible that... cause means something different when you're talking about severance. For example, Carly Fiorina is getting severance pay of $21 million, even though she was fired. You aware of that?
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You haven't read about that?
I have not.
Well, according to the newspaper, the reason she's getting her $21 million severance is that she was not fired for cause.
Well, I don't know what jurisdiction that's in, Your Honor, but...
the reason she was fired is that her performance was unsatisfactory.
And I don't know what her agreement says, Your Honor, but...
Well, agreement said that she was entitled to severance unless she was fired for cause.
Your Honor...
And the board said, well, you know, we're firing her because we're not satisfied with her performance, but it's not for cause.
I would disagree with that. I think it's the same in the severance agreement, and the Weir Court in the Tenth Circuit said it was the same with respect to a stock options agreement.
It's a matter of my curiosity. Could you tell me what newspaper that's from?
Pardon?
Could you tell me what newspaper?
New York Times, Wall Street Journal. You can take the Wall Street Journal if you prefer that.
I'm from Philadelphia.
I don't subscribe to that.
It's also on Fox News, too.
That one I understand.
Well, you've covered the whole spectrum, so it must be true.
You can cite it in your next brief if you want.
Getting back to her performance issues, we are not contesting the quality of her performance, Your Honors, but we are contesting the quantity of her performance. And to say that an employer can't use productivity as an indication as to whether the person is performing satisfactorily or not just doesn't make any sense.
Well, weren't there disputed issues of whether or not she was performing satisfactorily?
We say that there aren't, Your Honor. We say
well,
that.
I know you have to say that. Are you
right? If you look at the performance reviews, documents that where she was put on probation, the August 2001 letter, and then the February 2002 letter. She herself revised the February 2002 letter to show exactly what she was doing, and it was not up to what was required of her.
Didn't her immediate supervisor, at least up until the last week of her employment, say she'd performed exemplary service?
He said that the quality of her work was good. He himself had problems with her performance, Your Honor. If you look back to 2001...
Well, but I mean, he says it's exemplary performance. That kind of cuts against poor performance.
Well, he gave her... he had problems in 2001 with her performance. He had problems in 2001 in August when he issued that performance warning to her. He had problems with her performance in February of 2002. They're relying on an affidavit that he submitted well after he left the company. And at the time, he was in a litigation, and he's still in a litigation with the same person.
Can you weigh that? I mean, it's there.
It has to
Does
do with the
judge
quality.
Weigh that evidence versus when he was a part of the company versus now he has an affidavit submitted afterwards?
Your Honor, it just goes to the quality of the work. The written documentation in this record shows that as to the quality of the work.
There is a difference between what he said in his affidavit and what you're pulling out from prior statements when he was employed.
No, I think the substance of what he was saying, and if you read his entire affidavit, the exemplary performance goes to the quality. Even in his affidavit, he talks about billable hours and the fact that she was not meeting the billable hours target. He thought the billable hours target was too high, but he didn't say that she shouldn't have a billable hours target and that she shouldn't be evaluated based on that. And the year before, in August of 2001, he himself said he was having problems with her and he was going to have to work out some arrangement to terminate her employment or to get her working at a satisfactory level. And that is part of the record here.
Now, but it's interesting what you said about the billable and the difference between quantity and quality. What's to prevent, on your view of cause, what's to prevent the company from saying this? Well, all right, we want to get rid of her, and we certainly don't want to pay severance. So we're going to set a new a billable hours. We wanted to bill 5,000 hours a year. That's our new quota. And she fails to meet it, and so she's fired.
Your Honor,
is that okay?
That's not okay.
What's wrong with
you
that?
You could say in that situation that they have now asked her to meet a standard that was not the standard for the job for which she was hired. In this case, she was hired as a senior consultant.
You mean they can't change her billable quota?
They can't change it if it means that she is not performing the job for which she was hired. And in this case, that did not happen. She was always evaluated as a senior consultant. She was always given hours targets that were consistent with the job for
Wait,
which
you,
she was hired.
You lost me. So it wouldn't be cause if they had given her a quota that wasn't consistent with the understanding when she was hired? Is that what you're saying?
If they changed her job and they said instead of being a senior consultant, you're going to be a
president. Well, not changing the job. It's just that, you know, there, she has a quota to fill, right? She has a quota.
And her quota was the same the whole time. She was compared, if you look at these documents, and both of those documents that put her on probation said that she was being compared to people at her level.
Well, wait.
She was
That's
never
two
being
different points. Did she have a constant quota or a constant relative to other employees?
No, you'll see that the quota that she was required to meet in both of those performance plans was the same. 40% utilization, $398,000 in sales. And that $398,000 was lower than the quota for sales for other people at her level. They weren't trying to harm her, Your Honor.
How did that year of family leave play into this?
Your Honor, that was in 2000. She came back in 2000 from that, so it didn't play in at all. We're talking about performance problems in 2001 and 2002. She was back at work in October of 2000.
That wouldn't affect her quota? What happened to her quota?
Well, I don't think she did any work, so there was no quota for that period of time, but that's not what they're complaining about in this case. I'm not sure there's any evidence as to what happened in that year 2000 in this case on the record.
She says that what really happened was that there was less business available for her than the company had thought. That's why they got rid of her. Now, that would be like your RIF. The RIF case.
Your Honor, there's not more, that would be like the RIF, and there's not one piece of evidence on this record that would support that view.
But if there were evidence, then you'd have a triable issue.
Perhaps. What's the perhaps?
Why do you say perhaps? If there were some evidence that the real reason she was fired was that there wasn't enough work
But that's not her termination letter. If you look at the termination letter, that's contemporaneous. It's consistent with both of those performance plans, and it says that she was being terminated for cause. If we could move just to the bonus issue for one moment, there is a second issue in this appeal. I just thought that the bonus provision has two paragraphs.
Well, your opponent didn't discuss it in this argument, so you don't have to.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kaminsky. Mr. DeGrand, how much time do you have? You have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Judge. I think it's important to point out that the issue here is not whether the company could fire Ms. Joy, which I think...
No, I understand. Ms. Kaminsky says that there is absolutely no evidence that a drop in the company's business played any role in her being fired. Is that correct?
I don't believe it is. Mr. Basick testified that there were a number of factors that contributed to her inability to meet the billable hours goal. The economic climate that prevailed in the wake of the tragedy of September 11, 2001. The fact that the company was itself making it more difficult for her to generate and bill hours. And a host of other factors that are set forth in Mr. Basick's affidavit. And again, Mr. Basick was not even deposed in this case, so the court rejected that testimony just on the basis of the paper. With respect to the issue of whether she had this consistent billable hours goal, the record is quite contrary to what's been represented to the court. In fact, the lower court, if you read the opinion, accepted as true the fact that when she was hired in 1996, she had no billable hours requirement at all. None. Because she was hired to start this practice and service it from an administrative standpoint. She had other important administrative duties, and that was accepted as true by the lower court, but he said in August of 2001, the court ruled, they put her on notice that the rules had changed, that now she had this billable hours requirement, and therefore it was incumbent upon her to meet it. While I don't disagree that she had a duty as an employee to try to meet that, that cannot change her contractual right to severance without additional consideration. That is a contractual modification to her detriment that is unsupported by consideration, and it's not enforceable. And if the court has no further questions, I'll stand on the briefs.
In that regard, didn't she receive a pay raise when that change happened?
No, she did not, Judge. She had received the final raise the January before.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Grant and Ms. Kaminsky. Next case for argument is